Welcome to another conversation in the Neon Jazz interview series with legendary trumpeter and flugelhornist Randy Brecker. Over the last four decades, he has helped shape the sound of jazz, R&B, and rock. He grew up in the music-rich home of John Coltrane in the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia. He talks candidly about quite a few things, like a State Department trip through the Middle East when he was younger, what it was like to perform with Stevie Wonder, why he loves jazz, insights into the Brecker Brothers' beginnings, what is the proverbial next in his career, and a host of other wise insights and flavor-rich stories. Dig this interview, my friends.
I'm just going to go ahead and dive right in and ask, what has been going on with you lately?
Whoa. Well, I've been doing a lot of different things. I just came back from Europe with Mike Stern, who I've been playing with either as co-leader or sideman or whatever for about 6 years. Not that regularly, but it's always fun. This particular band features Steve Smith on drums and Yannick Gwizdal on bass. Really great quartet. And we toured Europe as far as London and Turkey and everything in between for 2 weeks. After that, I had a gig with my own band, but we got rained out in Denton, Texas, the Denton Arts and Jazz Festival. So we flew down there and did a sound check at least. This weekend I'm playing with Stern at in Boston, and then I go down to New Orleans and do a featured guest spot with my old friend Mac Rebenek, Dr. John, who's doing a tribute to Satchmo. So I guess I'm Satchmo for the day.
Very cool. I want to start out with the beginning of your life. You grew up in Philadelphia, and I want to know, how profound was Philadelphia in garnering a love of jazz for you?
Well, I actually can barely put it into words. It was a combination of being in Philadelphia, which was such a bedrock of not only jazz musicians, but it was every style of music was represented there. It was really a melting pot. So I learned early on about different styles, R&B. It was the birthplace of the B3 organ trio. Jimmy Smith, who was a piano player, decided to change up, and a lot of other people followed, so every little bar had a B3 group. I studied with Sigmund Hering and the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I went to hear them quite a bit. It was the birthplace of American Bandstand, and Dick Clark would have on a bunch of R&B African-American bands live on TV. So it started around 3 o'clock after we got home from school, so we were exposed to that. I played with a lot of blues bands, did a couple shows, Bye Bye Birdie, backed up some of the local singers like Bobby Rydell, who was actually a good jazz drummer, and Frankie Avalon, who was actually a good jazz trumpet player in New Jersey. So And besides all the work, there were just these, people like Coltrane who resided in Philly for so many years and went and practiced with Jimmy Heath and Benny Golson, and there were just hundreds. I mean, a lot of brothers, the City of Brother Love, the Brecker Brothers, the Eubanks brothers, the Heath brothers, Ray and Tommy Bryant was a wonderful saxophone player. Billy Root, his brother, was a drummer. Lee Morgan had a brother. So there were a lot of the Grubb brothers, who were cousins of John Coltrane. So there was always something going on. And, of course, there were two clubs, Peps and the Showboat, that had named groups. So that was the first place I heard Miles and Coltrane and Mingus and Monk, along with the Red Hill Inn out in New Jersey. So my father was also a piano player, so semi-professional, but he knew all the cats, and there were jam sessions at our house quite a bit with some really good players. So I can't underestimate how important all that was. Clifford Brown was alive and playing regularly with Max Roach in the early 50s, and I didn't have an opportunity to hear him live, but my father would go all the time.
Yeah.
So just imagine all that. Boy.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's amazing. So when you were growing up, what did you want to be when you grew up? Did you always want to get into music, or was there other aspirations?
Well, I think we were predestined. When I was 2 weeks old, my father wrote a song about me that was called, I actually had him re-recorded on a record I did called Into the Sun. I had him come up to New York shortly before he passed away, actually, but at the time he was in good health. It was a tune called The Hottest Man in Town, dedicated to me. I was 2 weeks old when he wrote it, and he forecast that I was going to play a horn, maybe a hot fife, and love music even more than my wife.
Wow.
So I think it was all, we were both, all three of us, I have a sister too, who's a wonderful pianist and harpist, and we were kind of predestined toward that lifestyle because we just had music around the house all the time. At
right
the same
on.
Time, he would gently try to dissuade us. I tried getting interested in, you know, communications. I like to write, so I was into reading and writing papers and other creative endeavors, even went to art school and things like that. But music was always first. We couldn't get away from it.
Sure. So when you went to Indiana University in the mid-60s, what did you learn there about music? What, like, your real kind of baptismal in the university life?
Well, I went there in 1963 through 1965, and I was studying privately with Dave Baker in Indianapolis. At IU, they had a great performance program, but not a great jazz program yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I played with an incredible band. In fact, we're having our almost 50-year reunion in about 2 weeks, the IU Jazz Ensemble, who won the 1965 Notre Dame Jazz Festival, and I won a trumpet award, which was given to me by Clark Terry. But the upshot of that was we were offered a 16-week State Department tour in early 1966. So off we went to the Middle East and Asia, the whole band, and we toured for 4 months. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
Constantly in all the Arab countries, everywhere where there's just horrible things going on now. We
yeah.
were there, and it was just a life-altering experience, including even going to a couple of us stowed away on a bus and went into Afghanistan through the Khyber Pass, which we weren't supposed to do, and went to a place called Thieves City, which was just a whole city of contraband.
Wow.
So it was just mind-altering, and we got to play every night. It was a really good band. I have a recording. It was swinging. You could never tell it was a college band.
Wow.
And that's what shaped me as a player. There were a few guys in the band older than I was that coached me, kind of, and just listening to guys like Jerry Green, Gary Campbell, who teaches at FIU and has many books out, and Whit Seidner, who is a baritone player, wrote a lot of the charts, headed the music program at the University of Miami. And I went from there to Europe. That summer, played with Don Menza in Germany and met a lot of European musicians, and I ended up finishing it. I didn't quite finish, I can't say that, but I went to, instead of going back to IU, I went to New York University, studied with Ray Grassar, a great classical trumpet player, in 1966, September, and I got quickly kind of sucked into the music scene. There was so much work, particularly studio work.
Yeah, well, so speaking of profound growth, when you arrive in New York City, you play with Clark Terry's big band, Duke Pearson, Thad Jones, and Mel Lewis. What were those early years like to play with such forces in jazz?
Well, I remember those first 3 or 4 years really clearly, you know, because my eyes were so wide open, almost falling out of the sockets. I couldn't believe I was playing with all these great guys. I met Mel at another competition that summer where we were in, when I was in Europe, there was a jazz competition in Vienna, and he was one of the judges along with Art Farmer, Cannonball Adderley, J.J. Johnson, Ron Carter, and Joe Zawinul. So I got friendly with all those guys, won a trumpet prize, and Mel asked me to join his band, Thad and Mel's band, when I got back. So things happened pretty quickly, and it was just a period of growth. I mean, if you're playing with guys that great, your own playing is immediately enhanced, and you have
yeah.
to be at the top of your game all the time. So that was just an unbelievable entry, and the first 2 or 3 years in New York were just incredible.
Absolutely. So when you ventured into Blood, Sweat, and Tears, which is more of a jazz rock fusion, why did you kind of take that turn from traditional jazz into a newer sound?
Well, I had grown up, you know, I had a kind of an open mind, and I played in a lot of pop and, like I said, R&B bands in Philly. And the band was made up of mostly jazz guys, particularly a guy who I knew, Freddie Lipsius, who completely coincidentally I talked to last night for about an hour. He was a great writer, and they had some good tunes. There were good charts. Everyone was a studied musician, and I quickly learned that it was great being a jazz musician, but a lot of these gigs, even with the great big bands, didn't pay very much. Sometimes we got as much as $5 a night playing with CT's band or with Duke's band, and even playing with Thad and Mel's band, that paid $20. Yeah. And the guys were all doing studio work to support themselves, but I hadn't as yet kind of gotten into that. So when Blood, Sweat, and Tears came along and offered me a salary every week, I said, well, let's give it a try. And I enjoyed myself. I learned a lot about the business from just seeing how many people, you know, came out to these concerts. I mean, we went out to California and played opposite Cream and Stevie Winwood and Traffic. There were thousands of people in the audience, all loving the music. So I can't tell you how much I learned from being outside the parameters of the strict jazz life.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk to me about your years with your fusion group, Dreams. What was that experience like?
Well, that was kind of an outgrowth of everything I had done so far. You know, I left Blood, Sweat, and Tears to join Horace Silver, of course, just to get out and play. You know, the one drawback with BS&T was I only got one, maybe two solos a night. The rest were playing horn parts, great as they were. I didn't get to stretch out very much. So I stayed with Horace for a year and a half with great Billy Cobham on drums, John B. Williams on bass, Benny Maupin on saxophone and bass clarinet. And at one point, Horace broke up the band. It was kind of sudden, to tell you the truth. He gave us 2 weeks' notice. So Billy and I came back to New York, and in the interim, my brother had moved to New York and met a trombone player named Barry Rogers, who in turn had been collaborating with two singer-songwriters, Jeff Kent and Doug Lubon, who had some kind of really nice, open, kind of popish and vampish kind of tunes, and they needed a trumpet player and a drummer. So I said, hey, Mike, why don't you hire us? We're just back in town. Horace broke up the band, so that's how the group started. And the whole idea behind that band was to improvise the arrangements, not write anything out, not have any charts like Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears, but just play the tunes and improvise parts. And all the arrangements just slowly evolved and were constantly changing. So it was a jazz rock band with really an emphasis on the rock. And people hadn't heard like my brother. They hadn't heard a saxophone played like that before. And they certainly hadn't heard a drummer like Billy Cobham before. They were just transfixed, particularly on Billy. He was really the centerpiece of the band. And Mike was, of course, playing great in his formative years, as was Barry Rogers, just an incredible trombonist, very exciting. So that was a real exciting period. We became the house band at the Village Gate and met a lot of other musicians and contractors and made a name for ourselves in that kind of genre, so to speak. And that kind of helped with our studio work, I guess, because people started calling us as a section. And unfortunately, the band never achieved great commercial success, but we did do two records and had a cult following, and it really kind of set the path for Miles's band, who used to come and hear us and eventually hired Billy Cobham to play on Bitches Brew. And we were using all the effects, and I think maybe that had an influence on them too. They would come to the gig and never say anything to any of us. And I guess this was mid-1969, right before he was getting ready to do Bitches Brew. So yeah. We like to think we had some influence there, too.
Yeah, cool. You know, I always hear it's an amazing experience to play with family members, and you played a lot with Michael. What was that like to be on stage with your brother and to make that music that you made with the Brecker Brothers?
Well, we kind of always had a sixth sense when we played together, even as kids. You know, he was 3 years younger than I was, and he started on clarinet, and we started improvising from listening to records early age. We were both about 10. I mean, and he started also when he was 10. I think he started to play when he was 8. But by the he was 10, he had a lot of facility on clarinet, and we would just go in the bathroom. We liked the reverb and the echo in the bathroom that separated where we slept, and we just wail free. And, you know, he was just incredible. He was a quick learner, obviously really, really talented, but had a real strong work ethic. And we didn't have to talk about nuances like phrasing or where to put the pitch or when to use vibrato. And we both had similar concepts as far as playing with the notes, the space in between the notes. So it was a real great relationship.
And so speaking of relationships, it must have been really an amazing experience to be around someone like Art Blakey. What was it like to be around him?
Well, he was just an immovable force. I remember we were playing in Boston. It was a foggy night, and we were walking around Berkeley in the back. I guess our hotel was kind of in the back bay, and just the sight of him walking through the fog always stayed with me, the way the fog parted when he walked. He was a fast walker, and watching the fog part in his way, he was just such a strong force, just, you know, all about music. I don't think he thought about anything else.
Yeah.
And even though that period, I was only with him, I guess, really less than a year. It wasn't a great period for him. He was having financial problems. And stuff happened that, you know, you read about, you know, get to a gig and he doesn't have the money and leaves you stranded in this place or that place. But still, I wouldn't have traded that for anything, just being able to play all those classic tunes. And we had a good two-horn. The saxophone player was Carlos Garnett, Panamanian, a wonderful saxophonist. And he was there most of the time. So we had a little thing going.
Yeah. Yeah. One other musician I'm curious about that is, again, a huge force in music. What was it like to be around someone like Stevie Wonder?
Well, that was also a thrill. I was taking my good friend Steve Madeo's part. Steve had, I think, gone through one mini bar too many during the time. He's, of course, stopped doing all that stuff for years, but he had fallen off the stage and fractured his skull.
Yeah.
And a good friend from music camp, Dave Sanborn, was in the band as a horn player. So Dave recommended me, as did Steve. We were friends. Whenever they were in New York, I'd go hang out. And I was with Stevie about 9 or 10 months regularly, just on the road. And what people don't realize, as genius as he is, and he of course is, that he would spend every waking moment working on the music, headphones on, thinking of ideas, changing stuff. He was working on songs in the key of life, so we were doing all that material. And he'd make little changes every night, or let's do this here, let's do that there. And he was just 100% on every night. It didn't matter what happened, how many miles we traveled, we'd be dragging our butts up on stage, and he would just put on a hell of a show.
Yeah.
I remember one night at the Apollo, there was a little brawl. A couple guys got into, in the crew, got into a fight in the dressing room. Kind of a really bad fight, too. We had to break it up, and we're all completely nervous. Stevie said, well, you know, I would have tried to break it up, but what can a blind man do? He had a really good sense of humor. So we went on stage, the whole band's kind of nervous, and he just killed it, just like nothing happened.
Wow. Wow, that's great. Speaking of Miles Log over the years, you've gone around the world on world tours. How does that play on your brain to see that many places in that amount of time? It has to be an exhilarating experience.
Well, particularly when you're young, it gets a little less exhilarating when you get up there because it's just harder, you know, and the jet lag and the airlines, the whole thing that's evolved in the airlines isn't great. You just have to deal with it. And all the crowds, you know, there are less flights, so all the flights are packed to the gill. But I still enjoy seeing the expressions on people's face when we play. And the fact that Eastern Europe opened up so much was great for jazz.
Yeah.
I actually brought a band over there. I'm trying to remember the year. Steve Smith was in the band. He seemed to remember it being 19... 88. Anyway, it was about 6 months before the communism fell in all those countries. We went there when it was still behind the Iron Curtain. And to see the expressions on these people's face when we played, and it's still there. I mean, they still are only into their about 20th year of freedom. And you go to, our last gig with Mike was in Prague, and the people go nuts over the music. It's like they're listening to the Beatles. So to see a beautiful city, just to name one, Prague is one, really one of the most beautiful, incredible places in the world. There, I heartily recommend to your listeners to go to these places, Krakow in Poland, Warsaw, Budapest. There's a lot of culture, beautiful buildings, and you can almost skip Paris and London, where they're really crowded in the summer.
So you played with a lot of jazz luminaries over the years. You've also played with James Taylor, Frank Sinatra, Steely Dan, Zappa, the list goes on. Is there anybody, not that you sit around and think about it, but is there anybody that you think, man, I'd love to get on stage with them at some point?
Well, there is one guy. I never played with Sonny Rollins.
Wow.
And I met him, and he was very friendly, and he was a big fan of my brother's, and he's a sweet guy. And I've known his right-hand man, Bob Cranshaw, ever since I came to New York. Bob's actually been with him for 50 years or more now. So sooner or later, I hope I get a shot.
Yeah, right on. So for four decades, you've been a force in jazz, R&B, and rock. Tell me, during that period of your career, was there one period that was more creative and magnanimous than another period, just something that really made you grow exponentially?
Well, I'd have to say the early 70s, when I really started to write for myself. And the original impetus behind that was the fact that Dave Sanborn had moved to New York. Now, I went to music camp at Indiana University with Sanborn when we were 15, and we really hit it off. We had, even at that age, kind of similar interests and similar conceptions. And when he moved to New York, we used to go. He would be in New York before Mike moved to New York occasionally with Paul Butterfield, blues band. We'd go get together and practice together, or go to a practice place and just play together or practice together. So I was very close with him. So the idea was to get Mike, me, and Sanborn as a horn section. I started writing with that in mind, along with having people like Don Grolnick and Will Lee, who ended up being in Dreams, the last incarnation of Dreams, Chris Parker on drums, and Steve Kahn on guitar, along with Buzzy Featon, I think, was around too. And I started writing charts. I had nine charts finished. And so that was a real creative period, some conceptualizing some Skunk Funk and Sponge and all those tunes.
Yeah.
And it was great fun getting together with these guys. We were like a fusion rehearsal band. Grolnick was writing stuff for himself. Steve Kahn was writing, so we played some of their stuff. And that eventually evolved into the Brecker Brothers Band, named by the producer, Steve Backer, who said, if you call this band the Brecker Brothers, I'll sign you to a record deal with Clive Davis right now. And I said, at first, I said, no, this is my, I wrote everything. This is my solo record. And how it looked, Dave Sanborn, long lost cousin out front, doesn't look right.
Yeah.
But I relented, and that's, and then we did a single at the request, a strong request by Clive Davis, who called me up to his office and said, I love everything you recorded, but unless you do a single, I think it's going to sit on the shelf a while.
Wow.
So we went in and did it, and that's what really sold the band. We did a tune called Sneaking Up Behind You, which we just went, harkened back, I swear, to our Dreams days. We were still good at jamming up stuff.
Yeah.
And we went back to Grolnick's pad, and I still have the tape. We jammed that thing up in about 4 hours, the whole thing.
Wow.
The force was with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
We went in and recorded it the next day. Clive, thankfully, loved it, and that tune got up to about number two on the urban charts, which is a lot, and it made the record, instead of selling 5,000, sold a couple hundred thousand, and next thing I know, we're doing big festivals opposite Chaka Khan and Parliament Funkadelic, so that was all a big thrill.
So if you take yourself back to the very early years of playing and think about today when you get on stage, how do you feel today versus the way you did when you started out? Is there a big difference to how you approach the stage?
Well, physically, it's a little harder to jump up and down, you know. That's the main thing. But, you know, nothing changes that much. You just try to do your best, and I was and keep your eyes on, this was something I learned early on in Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Al Kooper said, keep your eyes on the first few rows and see how they're enjoying it and kind of tailor the show, you know, towards the audience. So I've always tried to keep the audience in mind. And but you just, you know, you just go out there and you have to do your best, you know, because they're expecting it.
Absolutely. So tell me, why do you love jazz so much?
Well, I think, number one, because it's all I knew. I grew up with it, and it's, I feel as close as I can. It's like my religion, so to speak. It's a really spiritual thing because it's, you know, a non-human entity that brings so much joy into one's life. The freedom, the fact that it's a bottomless pit of information, you never feel like you have it all under your fingers. And there's always more to learn, and it's just there's something to do every day, you know, with it. I have to keep my chops up. I got to learn something new, write a tune, write an arrangement, make a few phone calls. So it makes just keeps life really interesting. But the main thing, I think, is just the freedom to express yourself, improvise, and play an instrument that you love.
So over the years, you've played with so many people that the world would consider music heroes. Who are your music heroes?
Well, I have a lot of them, man. You know, I don't know if I could center it into two or three. As a hobby, I kind of collect jazz photos. I grab them off, you know, the internet and stick them into my iPhoto thing. I probably have a couple thousand photos of musicians that I love and emulate, and many of whom became friends. But I suppose if I had to pick two or three, they'd be trumpet players: Miles Davis, Freddie Hubbard, Monk, Mingus, Charlie Parker. No unknown guys. You know, it's all the usual cast of characters: Thad Jones for his writing and completely inventive playing, Kenny Durham. In the rock world, you already mentioned Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles. Love music from New Orleans. So happy to. I haven't played with Mac, with Dr. John, in a few years. We used to play together a lot, so I'm looking forward to that gig on Sunday. And I love world music too, Indian music, and because I've traveled so much, music of Eastern Europe, Bulgarian folk singers, and it's hard for me to narrow it down. It really is.
So, of all the awards that you've been given and all the accolades that you've been given over the years, is there any that kind of sticks with you as kind of something that's a little bit more special? Not that it's better, but that it's like maybe an early award, something you're like, man, I really remember when I got that and how it made me feel.
Well, I think the first time I won a Grammy was just a big thrill, and it was unique in the fact that I had known I was nominated, but I was at Ronnie Scott's playing with Billy Cobham and Billy's band, special edition. I think this was 1990, early 90s, I suppose, or late 80s. I can't remember the exact date. It was a record called Into the Sun. And I had known it was nominated, but I didn't realize that the award thing was that night. So I was given a note in the middle of the second set that it won a Grammy, and I was just thrilled beyond belief.
Wow!
Because it was a particularly, I liked that record. I had written the whole thing, number one, and I had a lot of really good friends on it. It was a perfect storm, so to speak. All the pieces of that record really fell together. So, and because it was the first one, and it was just a thrilling night, a night I'll never forget, and we had a little party in between after we got done to celebrate.
That's a great story. Let me ask you this. What is the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Well, the greatest thing for me is looking at my wife and six-year-old daughter. We have a six-year-old daughter, Stella. I'm really happily married, and I love them both so much. So that would have to be first, just watching them sleep, because I usually wake up a little before they do.
Yeah.
But then just, you know, having a full day to figure out what I'm going to learn or what I'm going to focus on.
So in an amazing career that you've had up to this point, in a proverbial sense, what is left for you to accomplish? Or what do you want to do?
Well, that's a good question. I have one record in the can that we're going to start mixing next week. Let me mention that. It's kind of like a bookend record where we pick 10 tunes that in the pop world that I played solos on, like Bruce Springsteen's Meeting Across the River and Todd Rundgren's Hello, It's Me, and some Paul Simon, some Bette Midler, some James Brown, a plethora of really great artists. And Kenny Werner wrote some charts completely deranging everything. There's one tune from Blood, Sweat, and Tears, I Can't Quit Her. You can barely recognize this stuff, and we put a great band together, featuring my daughter, who's singing on some things, Amanda Brecker, Kenny on piano, John Patitucci, Nate Smith on drums, Adam Rogers on guitar, and David Sanchez. So that's going to kind of like be a kind of bookend project, since it kind of mirrors my career really throughout many decades. So that'll be out sometime, I think, in the summer or in the fall. And after that, you know, the trumpet's a challenging instrument, so I got to spend time doing that. I think I'd like to do just some more straight-ahead, simple, go into a studio and either write some tunes, do some standards, and just blow. Because I haven't, if my recording legacy is a little short in one direction or another, it's that. Most of the records that I've done are really well thought out and produced. So I know this stuff doesn't sell that much anymore, but it's something I'd like to do, just go in and 6 hours and do a record.
So I know you're a long way from being done, but if you would have to think, how would you like the world of not only just jazz, but music, how would you like them to remember you and what you did for it?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one to answer myself. Well, just I hope the main thing is that I hope I gave everyone a lot of enjoyment. I mean, that's another and probably the main reason we go out there is that, as simple as it sounds, we like to make people happy and maybe forget about their troubles for a couple hours and just focus on having a good time.
Yeah.
So that'd probably be number one. I hope I made a lot of people happy and kind of stuck to my guns and and played music that I wanted to play without too many compromises.
Well said. That right there, I think that wraps everything up. Randy, thank you for opening up with me. It's always a pleasure for me to have the chance to let my audience know who you are and giving me a little bit today. It was great.
Well, thanks, Joe. It's a great show. I was online checking it out, and continue all the great things you're doing, too.
Randy, thank you again, sir, and continued success.
Okay, thanks. A great interview, Joe. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to the legendary Randy Brecker for being such a cool legend and giving the world amazing music. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store or visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.